Welcome to all those who are embattled. Their own Gita story. So just a little bit of a summary of where we're in the introduction. We learned that what we're studying here is a parable, and it's applicable to all of our lives. And so all of the characters, all the places, everything has an inner meaning to it. And that we begin the first chapter with Arjuna in a state of despondency. Why? Because he's entered into this battle. He asked Krishna, his charioteer, to take him out to the middle of the battle and to survey the people on both sides. And when he sees the person who is lined up on the other side, the different people there, he sees their favorite teachers, relatives, all kinds of folks that he thinks, these are good and noble people. And how can I think about doing battle with them? And so he just would like to just throw down his arms and just leave the field of battle. And if we take that inwardly, that there are things that we have to face in ourselves. They're not all bad, all the oppositional forces. There are some things that have served us well in the past, but at this point in our development, in our journey, they no longer serve us. We have to go beyond them. And we look at them and we say, but that's a good thing, isn't it? Some things are obviously kind of like not good, things we want to do away with. But other things are a little more mixed nature. And so Arjuna asked Krishna, he said, you know, why do I have to do this? Why do I have to do this? And Krishna basically comes back and says, why are you disturbed by this? Because really, truth, reality in life is not this changing panorama. Everybody you see here on the field is already dead. It just hasn't happened yet. And so why are you grieving for that which is inevitable, which is going to happen? Reality is ever-existent. And so when you're attached to the things of this passing reality, it disturbs you. You get lost in the play. And sometimes you feel up and sometimes you feel down. Sometimes you feel great. Sometimes you feel miserable. And it goes on and on and on forever. And it's an illusion. Because the truth, the reality, always exists inside of you. It's always there. It's just your attachment to these things outside that make you feel like you've gained something, you've lost something, like you can kill somebody or you can be killed by somebody. None of that has any lasting truth to it. So learn jnana. Learn wisdom. Learn to use your sword and cut away those things that disturb you and distress you that have nothing to do with reality with a capital R. And so fight. Fight. Well, then the question comes to Arjuna. Well, let's see. You're telling me to fight, but this role of discrimination is what's really important. So why should I do anything more? And that brings us to today, because that's actually jumping a little bit ahead. That's chapter 3, and we're just on chapter 2. So this last... This last time, there's, as you can tell by reading through these chapters and Master's commentary on it, Papa's commentary on it, there's a lot in every chapter. There's a lot there. But in lieu of trying to focus us on a few things each month, I've chosen to focus on a particular aspect of that chapter for each month. So the introduction was seeing your life as an allegory. the second month in the first chapter with Sanjay as the witness and becoming the observer, and that's the requirement for all psychological and spiritual growth is to be able to observe your own experience. In the second chapter, then, is this state of jnana, or illumination of the intellect. And there we went through and becoming observant of this kind of battle that goes on around your attachment for things versus your dispassion for things. That's what jnana is. It's that ability to discriminate and to put things away. To say, this is reality, this is not ultimate reality. And there are gains and losses. Sometimes I feel happier, sometimes I feel sadder. But that's like a play on the surface. And that never really touches my deeper reality. And the jnana, in this case, is the mind's ability to dissect that and to cut away those things that are not part of the ultimate reality. And if something can be born or if something can die, it's not ultimate reality. It's a relative reality. Ultimate reality is ever-existent, always has been, always will be. Is true now, has always been true. And that this development of the discrimination of the mind, to cut away the things that are unreal and loosen your attachment to those things. So with that knowledge, you free yourself from fear of change. You reside in the equanimity of the mind, which brings you peace and bliss. So that's the ultimate for that discriminative mind, as you develop it to that point where you have that equanimity with you all the time. So, looking over this last month, and your journeys and your battles, how went the month? And I gave you a few study questions here. What did you notice in regards to being seduced by attachment? How went your experience this month with reminding yourself that you are a changeless, eternal soul, unaffected by the changeable world? And did you experience equanimity of mind through these practices? If anyone feels brave enough to offer a snippet of their lives?
Yeah. I had a very, very, very difficult month. But it was so good. It was almost like I went to a boot camp or something, you know, where afterwards you feel really good.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, there were days I literally, I mean, it was like I was hanging onto my bed going, I don't want to get out and do this. And even being in bed didn't help much anyway. Mm-hmm. But it was really hard to, because I was trying so hard to just focus on God. Okay, that's what it is. It's His life. I'm just living it. You know,
uh-huh.
I'm just working. I'm just here. And boy, it just, everything just was hitting me, and I would just, okay, it's free. Okay. It doesn't matter. Thank you, God, for everything that happens. And I'm like, okay, I can get through 1 minute. I got 1 minute.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally, I was down to, I can make it through this minute.
Right.
And I did, but the more I did it, the more I was, like, able to go, okay, breathe there. Okay, I can step aside. And I'm definitely not perfect at it or anything, but it's just I'm remembering how that I can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Put it that way. So, yeah, it's just, it's funny the things that were thrown at me over and over and over. I think like 6 or 7 times I would go and talk to someone, simple old thing, hey, got this issue with the accounts I'd like to work out. What? Threw it down to the paper. She told me I was nothing. Get out of there. I'm like, okay, let's back up here. I'm like, I just smiled at her and I left. I'm thinking, oh, God, that was kind of weird. But, you know, I was over and over, though. It wasn't just that.
Right.
So I'm like, okay, what's wrong with me? I figured it was just kind of maybe a mirror that I'm looking at or something.
Well, and sometimes things just come.
Yeah.
You know, you don't... the cause and effect is not necessarily happening in the moment, so it's not necessarily anything that you've done in the moment.
Oh, I didn't mean a mirror this moment. I meant a mirror for parts of me.
Sure.
Yeah.
So when you were successful at breathing, saying, this is God's life, and I'm just living it, what did you experience as a result?
Well, my chest wasn't so tight so that I could breathe.
Uh-huh.
And my muscles were like, oh, okay. That, my body loosened up.
Right.
And then I didn't have, I don't know how, if this makes sense to anybody, but my mind almost grasps onto things. And it's like holds on so tight. I don't know what it's holding on to, but just my mind even feels all tight and tense. And that I was able to say, okay, whatever happens.
Great.
You know? And so.
Great.
Moments. But when they did, it was so nice. It's like, yes, this is how I'm supposed to be.
Good work. Good work. It reminds me of the grabbing on was when I first took up meditation, and one of the things that had happened was that I had been injured when I was a wrestler in high school, and I had lost the entry into the state championships by 1 point. And this match kept on coming up. And if I had just done a different move, you know, and I would be really living it without noticing that I was doing it at all. And suddenly I was aware that I was thinking about this match, and my body would just be completely locked up and tense as I was straining with everything inside of me to make that extra move or something right at the last minute. And it was so funny because I'd be sitting on my meditation blanket in this completely tensed up state. It does get a bit crazy. Yeah? Okay.
You had asked us to write down when we had acts of courage, and so I found that writing that down actually helped me to be more courageous. Like, so it was good, and that's what I found. Like, it was really, it was a really tough one, but I feel good about how much different I've been in the months compared to, like, I see it as a pattern that is something I keep going to that same place or attached to that pattern, and that. I feel like that, you know, okay, I can listen to a tape, I can do something, I can do an affirmation, I can do, so I was doing more and more of that, so
to break that pattern?
Yeah, so that feels good, even though it's difficult, it feels like I'm handling a different thing, and that
right.
feels good, so, yeah.
Great.
It's not fixed, but handling a different way,
I think one of the things that we learn along the way is a healthy respect for the mind and how deeply embedded some of these patterns are. That it is, on the one hand, it's just a habit, and it's helpful to think of it, okay, because now I got a handle on that. If I created this, I can uncreate it. But that some of those habit patterns run very, very deep. And so just to think of it as a habit that you can just kind of shift gears in when you're ready to, okay, I'm done with that. I can, a very, very strong mind can do that. But most of us are in a tug of war with it. And it'd be very nice just to say, all right, I'm done with this, and it's gone. But most of us, it's, yeah. We're strength building to the point where we can do that when we can't do it, when we work on it. And this is like doing exercises in the gym to build up the muscles so that we can get to that point where we can do that heavy lifting. And so with the mind of Sri Yukteswar, say, enough, bang, and it's done. There's no second guessing. There's no going back on it. That's what we're building towards. And so if we can see ourselves as every time we have an act of courage, every time we do something to break that pattern, we're building those muscles up. to the point where we to the point where we can make that finality and enough. So I think I'm not an astrologer, but I think this last month there was something astrologically that must have been going on. That it's been a difficult time for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah, great. So acts of courage.
Yeah. And so that's what I think. I'm here saying this feels good. Like, yeah. It really does. So, hey, that's progress.
It is. Yeah. One of the things that came to me at one point was that the perfectionist inside of us is always looking for this place of perfection. Well, when am I going to do it right every time? You know, and when am I going to get a handle on this so I never make a mistake? So we tend to measure ourselves in those kind of ways. But if I'm on the battlefield, and I know this is my battle, and it is a battle, it's not that I get it right perfectly every time. So I know it's a battle, and I'm working at it. In a way, that's perfect in itself. I'm right exactly where I ought to be. I'm doing my sadhana. I'm doing exactly what I ought to be doing. Doesn't mean I do it perfectly every time, but I'm present and accounted for. And I'm here to tell you I'm not going anywhere. I'm counting myself in. I'm showing up. And there's a kind of perfection that's there. I can't control everything that comes at me. It's like with Jeremy talking about, I don't know where this comes from, but it's a mirror being held up here. So I can't control everything that comes towards me. And you look at the lives of any of the great masters, they didn't necessarily have easy lives. It's not that everybody thought they were great. You know, the Buddha had his detractors, people who thought he was full of hooey. You know, so it's not like everybody laid down their claws in front of him as he walked down the road. And it's even rumored that he may have been poisoned at the end of his life, that's how he left the body. So you don't necessarily look for perfection in that way, but how I approach it, what's my intention, how do I hold myself in integrity day in and day out, that I've got a lot of control over. And so I can be a happy warrior just being on the field knowing, okay, I don't know why all of this is happening, but this is exactly where I'm supposed to be. Exactly.
I heard you saying that, actually.
And what's the result when you enter into it in that way? What changes?
Well, there's a freedom.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also I have a lot more peace.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the anxiety comes, but I seem to be recovering quicker. But also, I have a lot more peace. And overall, I feel better, too, that about what I'm doing. I just feel like a sense of accomplishment that I am accomplishing something. Maybe it doesn't show out there, but it's I'm feeling it.
Like, right.
Yeah.
Right. Great.
Yeah.
Great. I call that being on track. You're right where you're supposed to be. Yeah. And it may not be perfect yet. You know, not in the way that we imagine it to be. But we're doing exactly what we're supposed to be doing.
And something is felt stronger that I am, that the hopelessness of feeling like it's not going to, but also there seems to be something stronger that says that I will get there.
Yes.
As well. So, yeah. That's
great.
Yeah, I came to that. She's talking about that, but I came to that point where it's like, now I maybe am able to learn it.
Mm-hmm.
I came to the point where, because before I didn't think I'd ever be able to learn, now I'm like, now I can even open it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the same kind of hopefulness. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had somewhere in the hope and just in the reading having sort of, oh, that's what we're talking about, and just having it in the text, where a lot of times I absorb things from reading better than hearing it.
Right.
And like when you're talking about the metaphor of a tortoise and the tortoise withdrawing his limbs, and the cycle, also like, oh, that's what I'm supposed to be doing during meditation. And so that was really helpful to have some of those ahas.
He withdraws his head too, besides the limbs.
Okay, so I still have more time. So, and I felt more detachment about things that I felt emboldened to sort of take a, not a staunch stand on, but just like, there's things going by that I need to be a witness for doing what's right rather than what's convenient.
Mm-hmm.
And don't need to beat the drum loud, just don't let it fly. Just gently,
yeah,
should do this.
How did you know the difference? How did you know what was right?
Because it was more probably rational than intuitive, but that strong sense of this is the greater good rather than the special interest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that those were the kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. And when you took that kind of stand, what did you notice as a result? What happened for you?
It's I was able to let go and keep detached from not having it have to go my way.
Mm-hmm.
Or what I thought was the right way. It's just like, I'm just here to present the facts, and then I didn't get all wrapped up and I have to hang on to it and see it through. It's like, this is what I'm supposed to do, and then I can move on.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very freeing.
Yeah. Great. So. Great. Now, freedom has come up several times. And, of course, there may be those times when you don't let go of it. I mean, no, it has to. It cannot go this other way. It must go this way. And that as that growing sense develops, then you can discern the differences between where you can let it go and, mm-hmm, I'm not letting this one go. Mm-hmm. His mother said she's like a dog with a bone, one end of the bone in her mouth, and she just wouldn't let go no matter what. Great. Yeah, I think reading the text, certainly, it's very helpful, and we process it in a different way than what we hear. And of course, Master can go into a lot more detail than, mm-hmm, what we can, like on an evening like this. So there's a lot there. I just encourage people, if they feel like that kind of gets them bogged down, not to get bogged down with that. Just let that go a little bit. This can be a lifetime study. You can keep going back to that well over and over again. Mm-hmm. So don't make it feel like this becomes cumbersome in some way. It should be inspiring.
Any other questions?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've had problems with anxiety for a long time, and I think things must be different because I'm doing so much to try and make it be different. But,
mm-hmm,
you know, I mean by that, by chanting and praying and trying to. But sometimes I can't stop the fearful thoughts. I can't just stop them with an act of will. I have to somehow do something. I don't know. So I guess my question is, when I'm in it, it feels the same as it's ever felt.
Mm-hmm.
How do I know if I am
making progress? It's an interesting act of what's called Maya or Avidya. Maya is the universal ignorance, the veil of separation that's come down between creation and its creator. Avidya is your individualized sense of separation from God. And that at one moment we can feel so enlightened, so knowing, so uplifted, and then that seems to fade into the background, and an old feeling kind of comes in and takes us over. And it makes us feel as if the other never existed.
I can't access it.
And you can't access it, right. In that moment, you know, it's just not available to you. And so what do? We fight. We keep concentrating on God. We keep using our sword of discrimination to cut away what is unreal. We recognize this is essentially unreal. What is real is, I've had that experience of what is real. Even though right now it seems like a distant dream, or maybe it never existed at all. There's some doubt, there's some question. That's all part of being taken over by that avidya, by that individual ignorance.
It's like my brain has been hijacked.
Right.
Yeah.
So
I have a feeling it's not good.
So you push forward with everything that you have. You don't give in to that. You keep affirming, this too shall pass. This too shall pass. This too shall pass. You keep affirming that. You keep cutting away that which is not real, that which is not true. Now, it's a mental action. It is what the first chapter, jnana, is really all about, or the second one, second chapter, is really about that discrimination and cutting that away. And we have to be quite ruthless. We can't coddle ourselves in there at all. There's no room for that.
I can actually feel, and I know that if I don't push back, I'm just strengthening the neural pathways that run fear in my brain.
Right.
So I don't want to allow it. It's kind of like having a mouse in the house, because you know there's more than one mouse, right? I don't want to be overtaken by
right.
Mouse. Yeah, so
right.
I know that.
So we can't always control being in bliss in the moment, because we have this karma. We have these things that we're facing. And when we think of conscious volition, we say, well, I don't will myself to feel like I'm feeling anxious, fearful, down, depressed. I mean, I'm not wanting to feel any of those things. And yet, they're hanging on me like a dark cloud, and they're not going anywhere. So in that moment, that's our truth. That's our reality. What we do have control over is our willingness and our ability to fight. To fight the feeling, to get through it, to take one step after another, not to give into it. And we know what that feels like, to kind of give into it and go with it. And, well, maybe that's just how I am, you know, because I've had this so often and so long. And, you know, you feel yourself sliding into it. And you don't go there. That's where you fight. Say, I will not do that.
I totally understand what you're saying, and I think I am doing that, although really imperfectly. But maybe this is just a complaint, or maybe it's a whine, but, you know, years ago I quit smoking, and it was actually really difficult, but I just did it. It was pre-patch, right?
Yeah.
So I just did it.
Right.
And probably, I don't know, maybe 100 times a day I said, I don't smoke anymore.
Yeah.
And I was successful, and
right.
it didn't linger for years.
Right.
And the same
Why can't you think your way out of
yeah.
this?
Yeah, and the same thing with drinking. I just said, okay, I'm just not drinking anymore.
Yeah.
That's just it. So I think I have had success in saying no to myself.
So what this tells you is this is a stronger oppositional force than either one of them.
Yeah, it is.
Which is pretty intense.
Yeah. And I remember sitting down on the meditation blanket, and this went on for years, and I would have a terror come over me. And I just thought, you know, I'm not an anxious person. But it would just come over me, and I would want to be anywhere other than sitting there. And it would have been the easiest thing in the world to get up and walk away from that and never have to deal with it again. So your mind will tell you. And you don't have control what comes at you, which also means inside of you, but what comes at you, what you do have control over is what you do with your mind then.
So in a way, am I right in thinking it doesn't matter if I'm successful? What matters is that I'm acting against the anxiety.
That's right.
Pushing against it.
That's right.
So because one of the things that happens is such self-loathing for not being able to stop it.
Right. And you just say, you know what? I don't have a choice right now to just lift myself out of this state. If I could, I would. But that's not happening for me. What I do have a choice over is to fight.
And so I guess I have to say one thing. I have to look at something happened in the morning. I woke up with what I would call sort of an anxiety attack, a rolling pin. And what I said to myself was, this is just a sensation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the first time I've been able to say that. So I didn't mm-hmm. get into, oh my God.
Right.
I'm going to go all to pieces.
Right.
Just, and I had two of them, and then I didn't have any more because yeah. I caught myself.
Right.
From going into the catastrophizing.
Right.
It's just a sensation.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. It's like people who have difficulty going to sleep. And now they lay down and they go, oh my gosh, am I going to have trouble going to sleep tonight? If I can't sleep tonight, then I'm going to be tired tomorrow. I can't stand this anymore. And I'm just, suddenly the person's just worked up into a total state about not being, well, of course you can't go to sleep. You know, the adrenaline is running, you're anxious, you're fearful. Just, oh, that's a passing phase. Nobody's ever died from lack of sleep before. You know, it's not what I prefer, but okay. And when you let go of it, you allow yourself to come down.
Yes.
And so that's what you did. You cut the legs out from underneath that feeling. You didn't give it any power.
Yes. I was surprised, actually, that I could do it. And it came up naturally.
And
you can, tactic.
You can do it every time. And so the feeling may hit you every once in a while, and the moment you do that, you break it. And eventually, it just has nothing left because you're not feeding it any life energy.
So I guess that's what I'm hoping for. It will be as eventually I could walk past a package of cigarettes and not think,
right.
I die for that.
Right. Yeah, it just isn't there anymore. When can that happen? You don't know. So you don't get focused on the outcome. You just get focused on being very good at just working your way through it when it happens. And it doesn't have to develop into anything else.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. You realize how much, and this is very humbling for me, I realized how much I was secretly feeding that anxiety and that fear that I was having.
Yes.
As much as I hated it, I was feeding it.
Yeah, well, I see that. I actually see that. That's, I suppose, progress, too.
And the great thing about that is now I can change it. Before, I felt powerless about it. Now I created it, I can change it.
And I think those thoughts, too.
So. Yeah. So you put yourself on the battlefield and you keep yourself there. You never give up. You never give in.
Okay, I like that. Thank you.
Yes. Good work. Good work. It's been an intense month. Anybody else?
Not unless you want bad news. Well, I kept trying to reframe how difficult things were as the more resistance there is, the better things are going. There was a lot of resistance.
Uh-huh. So if you're unattached to whether there's resistance or no resistance, it just is.
Mm-hmm.
It just is. And one of the divergences that I have around some of the positive thinking and things like that, they don't take into account karma, and that if you just change your thought, you'll change your experience. There is a truth to that, although sometimes that's not true. Sometimes things just keep coming. So you can't just shift your thinking and therefore shift your experience or what your surroundings look like. So if you let go of the idea that life should be different, that there shouldn't be any resistance, because I think implicit in your description is that it shouldn't be this way.
It's not that it shouldn't be this way. It's that it's very, 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 very uncomfortable.
Right. So once you take away the idea that it should be different,
mm-hmm.
what do you then notice?
Think there's less resistance.
Mm-hmm. I would say about, in normal cases, about 80% of the pain that we have, whether it's physical pain or emotional pain, is the idea that it shouldn't be this way. And that resistance to it being there creates more tension and more anxiety. And once we let that go and we say, okay, it's not what I prefer, but here it is. And it's obviously something that has to work its way through. And then in addition to that, feeling that you're letting it go. That you're letting it go, that you're not hanging on to it. And it's flowing through you. You're breathing it through. As you hear me describe that and you work that through your own mind, what do you notice?
It seems more achievable that it will just go through.
Mm-hmm. And it will. How long it takes, you can't tell. You just get really good at letting it flow through, letting it move through. Not fighting it, not resisting it. So it seems perhaps that I'm giving opposite kinds of advice here. One is to fight it.
Mm-hmm.
The other is not to resist it. And you'll sense what is the right thing to do with any particular thing. Some things you sense yourself, it's seductively drawing you in, and you know, I can't go there. I have to fight that. And something else, you just breathe it through. You let it move through. Let it flow through.
So isn't that fighting
itself? It's not in the same way. You're not stopping yourself from going into it. Rather, you're allowing it to flow, move through you.
But it's still a fight. You're still in the battle.
You're still remaining detached in both times, but in a different strategy. So at one point, Jesus said, "Resist the devil, and he shall flee." And another time, he says, "Resist ye not evil." And he's describing these two principles, that sometimes we let things go, we let them move through, we let them go. That's what we need to be in the business of. Sometimes we very definitely need to say, "No, I will not, you will not." And we generally know which is which when it comes. But we can experiment, and if one isn't working, we can switch strategies to see if the other one works better. But so oftentimes when there are strong, powerful emotions or other kinds of attachments that are flowing through, we find ourselves constricting and contracting. So to breathe and let it go, let it move through, let it move through. And it will move through.
Well, I had an incident where it was like the emotional meter was in the red zone. You know, something triggered something. I wasn't really sure why, but the emotional meter was way up in the red zone. And I just found myself just like almost consumed by this attachment sometimes. I'm not sure what, but I don't know what it was. But I do remember that. So my normal habit was to basically retreat and, you know, back off and, oh, this is, you know, my problem, there's something wrong with me and all of that. And then you had said something to me, well, do you think maybe, you know, something. And it was almost like a snap of a habit. Just all of a sudden it was like I kind of woke up. Like I almost put myself into a dream state with this emotion, because the emotional, you know, meter was so high that it almost like I put myself in this trance. And I remember you said something to me, and it was just like all of a sudden I just kind of woke up and went, oh, wait a minute, that's very unreal. You know, it was literally like waking up from some dream. And I immediately went into action, and I felt it, you know, slowly just kind of dissolve away. So I could see how I could easily get myself into these, like, kind of almost like an emotional trance. And that it's not, you know, and one of the things that kind of hit home to me when in reading his masters was that one of his was life is a battle. It's like verse 37. He talks about how life is a battle, and that even if you think you've lost or you have lost, that just for the fact that you're in the fight, that, you know, he kind of goes over that on and on about, you know, the importance of actually being in the battle.
Great. That's verse 37, huh?
But I can see how that old habit, or, you know, when I came out of it, I recognized that this was a habit of something. So, you know, observation is the first step in changing.
Right.
What you said.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I really that was a very clear message about, you know, observing my behavior.
Right.
And, you know, and being able to, you know, recognize that this was a habit that someplace I went. When something was stressful. And I really don't know exactly why it stressed me out, but I do, the feelings and the trance was a very, very familiar place for me.
Yeah. I think trance is a good description. we put ourselves into trances all the time. And anybody who's ever experienced any time of depression, say, can you just, you go into this little enclosed place where you don't notice the colors in the world, you don't notice things much at all, except just how to maneuver, hopefully, getting yourself through things. And you come out of that, and it's like coming out of a dark cave. And suddenly you come out into the bright, open sky and go, what was that? You know, where did I go to? And it was just something that completely happens inside of us. Yeah. So, you know, the Buddha means the awakened one. The one who's wakened out of a trance. Trance of this world that our ego mind has hypnotized us into. Great. Good description.
I had one situation. Well, I have several, you know, patterns that came back to me. But one that stands out is my boss is on maternity leave, and I understood her to say before she left that she was going to put in the paper or the whatever the paperwork and need to get a raise before she came back or something about so you wouldn't have to wait. And I was, you know, happy to hear that, so I didn't, you know, clarify, so I'm hearing this, is that what you meant, or, you know, any of that.
Uh-huh.
I was just like, oh, great,
yeah.
Nice. You know?
She volunteered.
And then I just took my understanding of what she said, and then, you know, she's gone, and then the acting supervisor, I said, well, you know, she told me I was going to get a raise in September, since that's the, you know. And it turned out, you know, there was no paperwork, nobody knew anything about it. And so,
old test of attachment, huh?
Yeah. Even though, you know, it's probably going to be like 2%, you know. But I, you know, I'm happy to have my job and everything. But like I was looking forward to it a little bit, and then, you know, I had to keep asking her about it a few times before she got the answer. And then it was like, well, there's no, we can't find any record of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the message from the boss about her was that since my last raise was in November, that, you know, November would be the earliest I could get another, because it has to be a full year or whatever. And I didn't like that answer too much, but I, it was kind of mixed. Like a part of me went into an old pattern about, you know, this isn't fair, and why would she have said that? Or have been gypped, kind of. But then another part of me was more detached. It's like, well, maybe I misunderstood, you know, what she said. And it was definitely a time. But around the same time, I had done a whole, in one of your talks, you talked about the gratitude list and doing that as a journal exercise. So I had done that around the same time or maybe right after that. And I realized, like, how grateful I was for so many of my coworkers and different small things that they had done. And you know, being in the economy that we are and everything great.
And what did you notice as a result of that?
That I wasn't as upset about it as I maybe would have predicted.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the old me would have been, you know, like, this isn't fair. And, that it was somehow, like, intentional. Or,
mm-hmm.
But I didn't, within a pretty short period of time, I was able to let go of that and just be like, okay, you know, so I'll get it. And go
right.
How big of a deal is that? Really?
I think one thing I like what you did around the gratitude and shifting the consciousness. I think one thing to recognize, there are times when we do stand up for ourselves.
Right.
But we do it differently from a different state of mind. And when we're attached, we get angry, we get frustrated, and it bends our perception. We don't see things quite clearly. We personalize things that perhaps were not meant to be personally, you know, attacks on us, and we interpret things very differently. When we're detached and we can stand back, then we can see more accurately that people, whether they are ill-intentioned or not. And we can read people, we can read situations more accurately. But when we get caught up, and we've all been there, where we get caught up in being angry about something, and we'll distort everybody's intentions towards us to be the worst possible kind of intentions. Why do they do that? And then, of course, this always happens. You know, that's...
Well, because there had been a misunderstanding when I was first hired.
Right.
And I felt that all... You know, I thought, well, I've surely let go of all that, you know, because that was 2.5 years ago. But it's like that all came
right
back
there.
And I'm like, they're not going to chip me again. You know, kind of thing. And, well, that was a situation where I did have to really stand up for
myself. And you did.
And it was
yeah.
not fun, but I did do that, and but this time it was more like within a day or two I was able to go back to my current supervisor and just say, you know, I kind of really thought about this, and I you know, I can see how what she said, you know, I interpreted it one way,
right.
and how she may have just meant
gave you a new perspective.
Yeah.
Great.
And and I sort of apologized and said if I was kind of gripey or about that, you know, I really apologize, but I was kind of confused and a little disappointed at the time. And she was like, no, I can understand. She's very
great. Great.
But I admire her.
Great. That's nice to have in a boss. Anybody else?
Well, mine is about the attachment. I guess I'm always aware. I don't feel like I'm that terribly attached to material things, so I guess I just never thought it was had any really huge attachment. But one night, this past month, I had a nightmare, which I don't usually have, that I was on a ship that was sinking, and I realized we were all going to drown. And then I was on a beach, and the water started receding, and I yelled, tsunami, we have to get to high ground, and everybody was running. And I was with some people, and I said, let's go into this building, we'll go up high. And we're in the building, and the building starts to sway. It's an earthquake. And there's an earthquake. We're running out of the building. And I wake up and I'm just terrified.
And then there's a gas leak. That's when it was really happening.
It happened about 2 days later, the next day. But
right.
but I really felt I was going to die. I woke up and I thought I'm going to die. And then I realized I don't want to die. Whereas in the past, just intellectualizing, you know, sure, dying is okay. I'll be with Mother Hamilton. I'll be with the gurus. It'll be fine. I don't need this body. I don't need this world. But I realized, no, I want to live. And the things that I was attached to, of course, was nothing material. It was the love. It was the being out in the sunshine, walking my dog, all of the emotional attachments that I really... It took me a long time to calm down, and then I went and sat and meditated because it was about 4 a.m. anyways. And like I might as well. I'm not going back to sleep because I'm going to dream about this again. But I was really surprised at the intensity of the attachment.
Yeah.
It was huge.
Yeah. So what do you do with that then? kind of knowledge, that experience?
Nothing. I just thought it was kind of strange. It was just a very unusual, intense experience. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, if I sit in meditation, I'm calm, and everything is fine, everything is the way it's supposed to be. It's wonderful. When I'm not in meditation, I'm
mm-hmm.
in the world, and it's, you know.
Here's one suggestion of maybe something to do, and that is to take each one of those things that came up for you. And, for instance, walking your dog in the sunshine, you know, through the trees. And then superimpose yourself into the astral worlds. And just check out and see if there's anything that's equally satisfying that you can experience there. And go back to each one of those things that popped up for you at that time. I'd miss this and this and this. And just check it out. See what see as you project yourself into that superior reality, would you really not have those things?
Yeah.
They'd be unavailable to you. And that as you teach, it's like taking each one of those parts inside of you and educating it to, you know, this physical body isn't the only way to have those experiences. And not only can we have those experiences, but we could have even ones that are even better.
Yeah.
And so you can utilize that then for going into each one of those places of attachment. Attachment in that case would be, only through this body can I have that experience, or that satisfaction, or that feeling.
The love.
Mm-hmm.
The love that we have in this world.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
It is.
And it's hard to imagine, because you don't know what it's really going to be like after you have the body. It's hard to imagine, are you going to have all of that love? Is it going to be as great? You know, is it?
You do and you don't, because you've had experiences outside of this body. So somewhere residing in your consciousness is that knowingness, is that knowledge. And so by projecting yourself into the astral then, or into the causal, is accessing some of that knowledge that you do have. And then just asking yourself, do I lose anything there? Is it all right? How does that feel? When you find that you don't have a big, heavy overcoat of a body to carry around, and you're light as air, and you can experience the sunlight and everything else, even more freedom, even more love, more joy. And you can release, it's like each one of those are little bubbles of attachment, and you just release them and they just pop. And the other thing that you can do is recreate the dream and say, okay, I got caught up in the panic of the moment. There's a lot of things coming. I was okay there and I was okay there, but
yeah.
By the third thing, you know, I was, you know, hanging on pretty hard there. And say, okay, if I could recreate that again, then what resources would I ask for, internal or external resources? Any of the masters to be there, God's light surrounding me, knowledge, you know, of who I really am. What would I ask for then? And then to recreate the dream and actually walk yourself through the dream again, only this time you're fully conscious and you have access to all those resources. And there again, you can go back to all those places of attachment that your dream was revealing to you, and expand them, show them there's more to this reality. And then see how that feels. Okay. So, powerful dream.
Yeah.
No sunburn.
No melanoma.
So, for all you Arjunites, we move on to chapter 3. Now in chapter 3, Arjuna starts with a question. If attachment is the problem and the development of jnana is necessary, the discrimination between what is real, changeless reality of spirit versus what is unreal, the constantly changing panorama of the senses, why then perform any action, especially one as fraught with difficulty as a war? So in chapter 2, Krishna was saying, develop this jnana, to differentiate between what is real and unreal. And this passing phenomenon is essentially unreal. Reality is unchanging. So Arjuna's thinking, well, why do I have to do any of this then? Why can't I just skip this part and just go to the end part? Good question, right? One we probably all entertain at one time or another. And Krishna, as the knower of absolute reality, answers, there is twofold way of salvation, jnana and karma. Karma is action, the field of action, this body and its interaction with the world. However, the kind of actionless action that Krishna is speaking of is not simply not acting, not doing anything, which is not possible. Because when we sit here, we're breathing. At some point, we get hungry, we have something to eat. We're active, we're in action. We can't say that we're not acting when we have all of these different things going on with the world. So what Krishna is talking about in chapter 2 of this actionless, becoming actionless, isn't a matter of just not doing anything with the body. Because as long as you're breathing, as long as you have any sense of body consciousness, you're in activity. You're in action. So you can't escape it by just not doing anything. So what is needed is self-control while you do your duty. To be like the turtle that withdraws its legs and its head, draws in and centers itself here, up and down through your torso, in your heart center, that this is the place of center for you. And that there is a knowingness that happens in your heart center of the I am, the true self that's there. And it's by staying centered there that you can feel this stillness even while you're in activity. So that's always with you. That's always with you. So by self-control and doing your duty, and you learn to be in the service of this world just like you are doing a holy worship, just like you are doing lighting the candles on your altar, or you enter into life like that. Whatever you do, whatever duty you're called to do, you have that kind of relationship with it. Like it's something sacred that you're doing. This is a sacred service that you're doing. You meditate on the higher devas, devas. That is, outwardly, those are images, spiritual images, gods and goddesses and things like that. Inwardly, they're the spiritual experiences. They're the feeling uplifted, the energy inside of you that's purifying. Those are the devas inside of you. And so you worship those uplifting kinds of experiences. And that if you receive those forces, life force, consciousness, intelligence, without any thought of its origin, where it comes from, that its source is with God, that's a huge mistake. And we all know people, and we ourselves have been guilty of it, of living in this world, using up all of our life energy and not giving a whit about its origin, where it comes from, what its real purpose is. And when we do that, we go further into ignorance. That's one of the penalties, that we get more and more body identification. We get more in a state of ignorance as we go along. So that makes one as good as a thief. Mother used to call it giving God burnt ashes. You burn up all your life force, and then, by the way, God, thanks a lot. You know, a little wave as you go by, and, you know, hardly any consideration at all for what we're being given moment to moment. That God creates this reality. It's not God created the world. God creates this reality, constantly flowing into it. And if he withdrew himself from this reality, we'd all be instantly gone. Nothing. So we're all dependent on that constant flow that comes from God. And that makes you humble. Egotists just use up the life force for self-satisfaction and remain in ignorance. Knowing oneness with God, perform the actions without attachment to their results. This is what real actionless action is. You have that inner stillness. You do what you do because it's the right thing to do. And you don't know what the results are going to be. Are you going to win the game? Or are you going to conquer in the battle? And Krishna said, it's better to do what you've been intended to do, what you're meant to be doing, and from a worldly standpoint, be a failure. But you do it with complete integrity from spirit. You are a shining success in the spiritual realm. But for those, they may be very successful in what they're doing, but they're not doing what they come really are meant to be doing. And even though they get lots of accolades from the world, and lots of money, and lots of fame, they're not doing it as they know they should be as a soul. And they are a stunning failure in the spiritual realm of things. So it kind of turns the world on its head. And so those people who look like tremendous successes can actually be incredible failures. Those people who look like they don't have a thing in a worldly sense can be wonderful successes from a spiritual standpoint. Think of a St. Francis, for instance, who just had nothing from a worldly standpoint, gave up everything from a worldly standpoint, and was such a tremendous spiritual success. Jesus, of course, is as well. So, knowing oneness with God, perform actions without attachment to their results. You will naturally lead others to their freedom. Krishna goes out of his way in this chapter 3 to say, don't try to convert other people. Don't try to tell them about this even. If they're happily sleeping in their delusion, let them sleep. It's all right. He's in charge of waking them up if they're being woken up. He said, but when you live your life this way, you're a natural leader. People will naturally follow your lead because they'll see that it's better. And when they have the eyes to see it, they'll see it. Don't worry about it. So he's actually kind of anti going out and trying to convert. No door knocking, no putting the foot in through the door and handing out the magazines. Not needed.
Who was it that talked about the fragrance?
Lori Mahashya talked about that. The fragrance of your practice, wafted up. People will naturally smell that aroma. They'll be attracted to it. Like-minded souls will be. So if God ceased acting, and he needs nothing. You know, you think of God doing what he does in terms of creating this universe. He doesn't need anything from it. He already has everything. But he does it for his play. He does it for his sport. But if he for a moment withdrew himself from this creation, we'd all be gone instantly. So I was thinking about that one time when I was a little bit feeling sorry for myself because I'd been doing different things and it seemed like there was no appreciation for it and all of that. And it suddenly hit me, look at what God's constantly doing. And doesn't demand one thing for himself. And he's been doing it for all these thousands and millions of years. And here I do one or two things, and I instantly expect, you know, something great from it. What a fellow this ego is. He's a grand fellow.
Can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
Is that metaphorically for God's... Because we say that, or I hear that, of for God's pleasure, for God's, or are we God's version of TV, you know? I mean, we're made in His image. Is that why I love a good story so much? Because God loves a good story so much?
I think so. What's implicit in are we God's TV is the sense that we're separate from God.
Yeah.
We are God. We've chosen to come into this reality and express ourselves as we are. We are this aspect of God who's enjoying this reality. So this is the stage. You ever be at a live play, you know, and you're watching the stage and on comes the actors. This is the stage. We are the actors. We're here to enjoy the play. That's what God meant it for. He said, however, don't get so caught up in the role that you think you're that role. Because then it's a problem. Because then if you lose something, you feel bad. Really bad. And if you gain something, you think you're something great, you know? None of it's true, you know?
It's just, actor.
It's just a play. Enjoy it for what it is. But we went against that principle and we got involved in this world in a way that we can. It's a choice, but then we don't like it very much. So then we have to work hard at extracting ourselves from it. And that's what we're doing. So resist the temptation to go out and make others realize this truth. Bhakti, devotion, also leads to non-attachment, the results of action. So this is karma yoga. This is learning how to act in this world. But for a bhakti, somebody who's awakening in their love for God, they will also learn about non-attachment. That's what the Lord is saying here. Desire and frustrated desire leading to anger is the foulest enemy here on earth. That's a quote. So when we have desire, and then when that desire gets frustrated, what happens? We get anxious, then we get angry, we're frustrated. Why isn't it happening? I wanted that raise for this month. Not because just the money, it's the principle, darn it. And suddenly, you know, we're like this. And Krishna says, whoa, just let it go, as you did. You're letting it go. And then you come back down and you go, okay, it's all right. God's in control of all of this. So, therefore, discipline the sense mind, destroy desire. Now, how do you go about destroying desire? He says, put your mind on the self, on God. It is superior to the mind's ability to discipline the ego self in order to conquer desire. And this is Mother's most fundamental teaching. Put your mind on God. Don't put your mind on the things you want to change. Don't put your mind on trying to not have desires. Because in all likelihood, you'll make the desire stronger. So withdraw your mind from the desire nature, put it on God. So you put it on the ajna, you put it on chanting, you put it on loving God, feeling God's presence, and let that lift you up. And that will put you into the desireless state. Just as much as trying to be very strict about, you know, like St. Francis, throwing some ashes on the food because you don't want to enjoy it. Some people's cooking, you don't have to put the ashes on, it's already there. But, you know.
Has its own charm.
So, that's a bit of a summary. And, of course, I encourage you to read the entire chapter. But the focus for this month is deepening your awareness of having union with God while performing actions. See the value of performing actions without attachment as an essential aspect of your sadhana. Some people can get into the, well, I read these spiritual books and I meditate, and that's kind of my spiritual practice. Then I go to work, and I do what I have to do to earn a living. They don't connect the two. Or, this is my family, I'll talk to them any way I want to, you know, and throw things around, and, you know, that's somehow disconnected from my spiritual path. People make divisions like that. And so this is entering into the field of activity and making it a part of your spiritual practice, your sadhana. It's an integral part. Arjuna is trying to say, can I just go away and meditate and not worry about this field of activity? Yeah. And we've all felt like that. You know, if I just had time, you know, then I'd meditate. Boy, would I be a meditator. I'd be meditating all day and all night. If I didn't have this stupid work to do and this family to deal with and all the rest of it, I'd be great. But people say when I retire, and then they retire and go, gosh, I just don't even have hardly any time to meditate. I'm just so darn busy. It's never ending. This is the place to do it.
I mean, well, I can be kind to people at work. It's my job. I'm a social worker. But then when I get off work and I have to come home, right, do I have to be kind to my roommate when he's following
right.
me to my house?
Right.
You know, that's a whole other thing. Like,
or that person at the store who pushes a cart in front of you. And
yeah, someone that cuts you off. Right. All those other things.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I have to do that all the time.
So focusing on controlling your senses, especially through keeping your focus on the ajna, on God, notice what happens when you practice this. That's in the field of activity. As you're going through, you can always keep your attention right here. There may be times when you have to give 100% attention to whatever you're focused on, you know, in the worldly sense. But even with practice, you can get where there's a part of your mind that's always the observer, always standing back, even when you're very focused on a particular action. And that's the place to get to, that presence of God is with you at all times. Learn to be in service through your action as if you are performing a sacred ceremony. What do you notice as a result? So you go into your, whatever you do in life, producing a good, a service, as a family member, whatever it is, and you enter into it, not in an ordinary kind of sense, but in this special sense that there's a sacredness about what you're doing. See how that shifts your attitude. How you interact differently with people and events when that's the case. Rather than giving burnt offerings of using up all your life force without any real thought of God, be mindful that the sacred life moving through you is a divine right that lifts you into the kingdom of heaven. So the life force itself, when you walk, when you lift your arm, when you speak, that's all part of the sacred flow that's moving through you. Can you connect that? Practice making that connection. Not disconnecting yourself from it. Not separating yourself from it. Observe how desire works through your actions, anticipating something good in the future and how this robs you of being present to the moment. So when you're always thinking about what's going to be the outcome, am I going to make some money on this, or am I going to get some job satisfaction when this job is done, I'm always projecting into the future, what's going to be the result of this, and how little I pay attention to being present to what I'm doing in the moment. And to slow myself down and to become present. Certainly I do things with an idea that there's going to be something as a result. If I start a project, I have some idea there's going to be some outcome to that. But my attachment to that it has to look just a certain way or at just a certain time, where my whole energy is always out there, I rob myself of the present. So just notice how that works for you. Also notice the relationship between attachment to desire and anger, and how we get frustrated. And anger is a really good thing. We can just trace it right back and say, okay, what was my attachment there? Oh, that person should have been acting differently. They should have been doing something differently. They should have been speaking differently. Whatever it is, we trace it back. And I had some idea that they should be different. And when they were different than how I was attached to them being, I felt frustrated, I felt angry, I felt betrayed. All of those kind of things come up. And those feelings take a big toll on me. So in practice, keeping your mind on God, to see what happens to desire nature and your attachment to results when your mind is primarily on God all the time. So those are just kind of hints for this coming month. Of different, you can read down through these and take one or take different ones and just begin your practice around these.
I'm having trouble kind of wrapping my head around this one, though, because when I think of a sacred ceremony, I'm thinking like, Korea and something, like really sacred. And so I'm trying to put it into my work situation.
Burlington Collision doesn't kind of manifest that sacred feeling for you?
Actually, a lot of times I could see God in a lot of people. the little pranksters and things. And I can see doing that, when I galloped through that thing and everything. I was just kind of like, I was thinking, wow, God, this is interesting. I just saw it as part of that. But it's like, how could that be sacred? Because it doesn't feel that whatever special,
Well, don't focus on the World Series and say, can I win the World Series? Can I start with some spring track practice first? So if you're sitting at your desk by yourself and there's nobody else in the room, can you just fill the room with light? And then as you go about doing simple actions, say you're moving pieces of paper and you're just kind of handling things, maybe filing, something that doesn't require your all, can you get a sense of the sacred there?
Yeah.
Okay. So then you just keep expanding that to the point where somebody could be very angry at you and you're seeing God in them and you're just feeling a rush of love going through you toward them.
Well, that's what happened with that gal.
Right.
It wasn't me, but...
And then that is sacred, you see?
Okay. But it is sacred, it's just, I'll have to, like I said, there's
a place in your mind that's creating a separation in there.
There's definitely a veil there that's like, that's...
And one thing to look at is to see, do you limit the concept of sacred to just a particular experience, or can it become more generalized? For instance, if a small child, a toddler, comes towards you and you just feel this overwhelming sense of love for this little one, a little smile and it's toddling and you just feel nothing but love, is that not sacred?
still have to expand my version of synchrony.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. Other thoughts or ideas for about this for the coming month?
How are we? Is reading the chapter a part of the assignment as well?
Yeah.
But don't get hung up on it if you can't.
Very, very definitely, I would read through all of the Gita script. So you can do that through the small book or through Master's Translation. Very definitely do that. As I said before, what I don't want you to do is to feel like if there's too much being given by Master that you have to take it all in and then you get bogged down with it somehow because there's so much there. So don't put yourself on a timeline that way. But draw from it what's inspirational, and you can do things at random. Just take readings of his at random, or you can be methodical and just every night you can read a page or two. Whatever kind of works for you. But I would definitely encourage you to read the Gita conversation all the way through. I realize there's a lot that Master is giving. And I realize that it's not a matter of not being interested, it's just being able to digest everything that he's giving, and it's a lot. And you may find that you can't digest it all. And that's all right. Bite off and chew what you can.
Yeah, sometimes I can digest more than others.
Right. Right, right. I think you could probably read the Gita script itself, you know, that one sentence or two. That's probably something, you know, for a night you could do that. It's tremendous.
Said things and talks, and I've gotten to a certain level, and
then,
I don't know,
just
starting to start. Yeah. You're not used to the house being full. Yeah.
So, any other thoughts or before we close up? Welcome.
The next one is going to be on the 17th. So it's the third weekend because we have a month.
Yeah, it'll be the third Wednesday.
The 17th of November.
All right. All right. Yeah.
So they have to get a cake or something.
Yes.
A non-wheat, no sugar cake? No.
There's some pretty good ones these days, yeah.
No wheat, no sugar.
Okay.
And you add no dairy and no eggs.
Right.
So let's have a closing prayer. Just pray after me. Heavenly Father.
Heavenly
Father. Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Krishna.
Beloved Krishna.
Saints and sages of all religions.
Saints and sages of all religions.
Bless us in our study.
Bless us in our study.
That we may enter into.
That we may enter into.
The divine state.
The divine state.
Of Krishna consciousness.
Of Krishna consciousness.
Of Christ consciousness.
Of Christ consciousness.
Of God consciousness.
Of God consciousness.
Now and forevermore.
Now and forevermore.
That you're all brave warriors on the battlefield.
Hmm.
beautiful picture of this thing?
Yes, it is.
The pictures from the book are different shapes.
This one is not from the book. I have an assortment of pictures, stands, postcards, and all kinds of places that I wouldn't be able to publish them in general, but I think there's no problem for our group.